Four pirates dozed on a mat on the floor. When another plane landed, two of them glanced up at me for a reaction. We'd spent the night near an airport. One pirate, Isa, was a tall, loping Somali who had guarded me on the Naham 3 and in Mussolini's farmhouse. Judging from the way he sometimes laughed with the other men, he had a silly sense of humor, but he stared at me now with a cold face. A dingy pink curtain hung in the doorway, lit by the climbing sun. The humid heat of morning mounted quickly, so Isa plugged in a dusty fan. He moved it to the doorway and aimed it at my bed, and I started to cough.
"Okay, Michael," he said.
"Not really." The other pirates woke up. I squinted at a new man who was shaking hands with Isa. He looked familiar. The guards pointed and smiled.
"Yunis,"
they said, and I remembered the translator from Mohammed Talil's safe house in Hobyon. My mosquito tent was from Mohammed's house, too, come to think of it. "Hi, Yunis," I said, but he adopted a haughty sarcasm I hadn't remembered in him.
"From today," he said, "we will be using Arabic names. I am no longer called Yunis. You should now call me Faisal."
"Really?
You must call me Faisal. It is my real name, my Muslim name."
"That seems complicated."
"You must do it," he insisted.
I did remember a rumor on board the Naham 3 that someone had shot Yunis dead. "I didn't think you were alive," I told him.
"Why?"
"I don't know. A pirate on the ship said you'd been killed by Al-Shabaab." He laughed.
"It is not true."
"So I see." After a long while, a new man unlocked the front gate to the compound and parted the curtain. He was smiling, handsome, young and urbane. He handed us two thermoses of hot, fresh tea, and he carried a plastic bag packed with tinfoil trays full of seasoned rice and meat from a restaurant. The food smelled delicious. The pirates handed me a tray, and I opened it on the vanity table, noticing on the plastic lid a sticker with the name of the restaurant as well as our current town. Gercasio, Somalia. Good to know. Three nights earlier, on a skiff, the guard called Bashko had predicted we would come to Gercasio. We'd pulled away from the Naham 3 in the dark, and I had stared up at our long, rust-streaked prison ship for the last time. It was dwarfed by the Albedo, which glowed like an industrial neighborhood on the water, lifting its brownish hull and stacks of sodium-lit cargo containers high into the marine mist. 10 pirates had crammed around me in the boat, and as we motored off, Bashko leaned forward to whisper, "Michael," over the slap of water and the rumble of the outboard motor.
"No problem. Tomorrow, Gercasio."
"Oh, yeah?" He made an airplane motion with his hand. "Adiga, free." The skiff pilot moved at a slow, deliberate speed, still under orders, perhaps, from Ture. By my own reckoning, we were south of Hobyo, maybe near Haradiri, and I thought I saw something blink in the sky far ahead, either a drone or the top of a cell phone tower. I wanted to jump. Certain instincts die hard. The pirates were tense and quiet. They maintained a tactical-seeming silence along the whole black and placid stretch of water, as if they wanted to avoid detection. We came to a skidding halt on the beach, and the guards hustled me across the sand to a pair of waiting cars. We drove north along unlit roads for 2 hours. When we settled, at last, in a shambling house, I breathed the dry odors of Somalia again. The dust, the ocean breeze, the wild, sour smell of certain insects, with the open-hearted gusto of a man who was about to go free. Untangling truth from pirate fabrications, never mind my own self-deceptions, could be tricky work. From the shambling house near the ocean, we had driven hours inland to reach this broom-closet bordello. The urbane-looking runner, who called himself Mustaf, stood beside me while I ate my breakfast on the wooden dresser. He rummaged through a drawer. When another plane shook the building on its way to what I took to be Galkayo's airport, Isa watched me again for a reaction. He giggled and whispered to another guard. Something odd was going on. I said to Mustaf, "Excuse me, what's going to happen? Am I going free?"
"Inshallah,"
he said politely, "if Allah wills it."
"Where are we now?"
I asked.
"You know Haradiri?"
he said.
"Yes." "We are in Haradiri."
I blinked. Bashko listened with a bright, alert face and seemed to hope I wouldn't remember our chat in the skiff. Had the pirates not even noticed the stickers on our meals?
"Really?"
I said.
"Yes." "There is much danger here from Al-Shabaab in Haradiri," said Mustaf.
"You must be quiet."
"I see."
I raised an obedient finger to my lips.
"Shh." Yes, yes. Haradiri, okay, I said. Yes.
Chapter 2 The broom closet bordello was not much larger than my cabin on the Nahum 3, where I had spent 3 weeks in solitary confinement. My brain moved back to the ship in sudden jerks, like someone punching rewind on a cassette recorder. You have made a mistake. Mistakes are human. To distract myself in the cabin, I had done push-ups on the floor, as well as a yoga routine on the bed. Li Bohai had excavated a spiral-bound notebook from somewhere on the ship so I could write, which may have been all that stood between my feverish mind and an aura of madness after my failed escape. You have made a mistake. Mistakes are human. On the first morning after my jump, the Nahum 3 stood somewhere along the coast, farther from the beach, and through a shoreward window across the hall I could see the distant shape of a cargo ship moving in and out of view. We wavered on our moorings in a strong current, like a flag moving in the wind. From my own porthole window, if I looked forward, I saw the rusted stern of the Albedo. The salt-streaked wall of greenish steel tilted back and forth about 50 yards ahead, and if I craned my neck, I could see the long cables tethering us together. Now and then they tugged with the strain. We hadn't moved ashore. We were floating in a field of hijacked ships. Ali Dulai came to my door on this first morning and said, "Eh?" as if he deserved an explanation. He stood beside my bunk and thumped me in the chest with his fist. My muscles were loose and thin, and I felt a chest ligament snap. It would hurt for several weeks. He also clubbed me several times along my body with a filled bottle of water and said, "No, no, no," and thrust his salt-chapped fingers in front of my eyes to rub them together. His eyes burned with incoherent rage. "Money, money, money," he added and stomped out. In the evening, now and then, Raleigh or Ha came in to chat. Raleigh said Dulai had beat him on the feet with the flat blade of a knife in front of the whole Nahum 3 crew as punishment for my escape attempt. My head swam with guilt and sorrow. I should have realized Raleigh might also be punished, and thinking about it was a worse punishment for me than the beating I took. I couldn't tell what to expect during my 3 weeks of solitary confinement, but there was a sense that I would leave the ship, so I showed Ha the stack of folded clothes I had borrowed from certain crewmen. We exchanged addresses on a scrap of cardboard. Food arrived twice a day on a plate. Tony or Big Jacket brought it. Big Jacket gave me a crooked smile of personal resignation, as if my leap had threatened his role as a guard leader. He disappeared, in fact, after a few days, and I never saw him again. Tony was more cheerful. "If you need anything, just ask," he said. The plates of food included a lot of defrosted tuna from the hold, either boiled or deep-fried. There was less fresh fish. We no longer floated near a reef. Boshko came in one afternoon with fresh soap and shampoo, acting friendly, good-humored with a polite manner but a lively, sarcastic smile. And when I explained my escape attempt by mentioning Garfanji and Al-Shabaab, he nodded. "No Al-Shabaab. No more Garfanji. Finished," he said, and made a grand sweep with his hand, as if he had personally banished these threats from my future. I stored the shampoo and soap in a closet that was cluttered with spare clothing and trash. The pirates had broken the closet knob. The door swung open and closed whenever the ship swayed. "You have made a mistake. Mistakes are human." One afternoon, the guard called Dag appeared in the sunshine outside my window. "Maiko," he said, and I shoved my notebook under a pillow to hide it. "You remember me," he said. "It is Dag." "Yes, Dag." He seemed groggy rather than hyper-alert, possibly also drunk, a vision of simple pirate greed. I could tell he'd been chewing cot from the ooze of green mash in one corner of his mouth. If I gave him a good shove through the window, I thought, he would lose his balance and topple over the rail. "We want your money," he said. "I know, Dag. I don't have any." "You are a writer," I laughed. "Yes, and writers don't make money." "But your mother—" The rocking boat challenged his feet. "Yes?" "Your mother, she doesn't have enough money either," I said. He swayed like a drunken sailor wearing a heavy Kalashnikov. "Michael," he said at last, in a tone of personal confession, "I want the good life." He was too far gone to maintain the mask of an honorable fisherman. He didn't even try to pretend. He was just a stoned bush soldier who wanted what he saw on TV. "I don't have the good life, Dag," I told him. "You guys kidnapped the wrong man." Chapter 3 The pirates in the broom closet bordello made an excitable show of standing in formation with their guns whenever I had to shower, guarding the short outdoor path to the toilet. The barren courtyard had a separate, small, unattached building made of crumbling stone, which I took for a storage room. I had to pick my way around it, past some automotive junk, wheel rims, electrical wire, to a tin-sided outhouse door. My first shower happened at night. I half-closed the outhouse door and stripped naked in the dark. I was told, mysteriously, not to look up. While I lathered my hair with shampoo and thought no one was watching, of course, I did look up. The outhouse was open to the sky. Nothing to see except blurry stars and the top of a stone-and-mortar wall. A guard noticed me break the rules, though, and the uproar and hysteria didn't subside until they had pushed me back into the bordello room, wrapped a brand-new chain around my ankles, and fixed it with a small brass lock. Why? I said.
Boss, speak. Michael Chains, said Boschko.
Someone had called the boss to rat me out, apparently. Now I had to be punished. I heard Raleigh's voice in my head.
Not make them angry, Michael.
But I had done nothing else but make them angry ever since my leap from the ship.
Boschko,
notebook, I said after a while.
Shut up.
Before we left the Nahum 3, the guards had searched my bag and discovered my spiral-bound notebook.
No, no,
Issa had said, as if I'd committed a crime. He rolled up the notebook, and I felt an ache of frustration. For the second time in my captivity, my notes had been confiscated. Now I had nothing to write with and no way to move, and a cold bicycle chain gritted the skin around my ankles. Late one night in the broom closet bordello, in early October, they loaded me into a Toyota Surf. We met another SUV on the outskirts of Galkayo, beside a lonely tree, and for 2 hours both cars moved like a caravan deep into the lunar wilderness. The drivers knew how to avoid boulders as well as acacia trees and thickets of thorn. Sometimes camels trotted into our headlight glare, and I was thinking about stories from the Old Testament. The elders and patriarchs. The armed brethren caught up in cycles of murder and revenge, when, somewhere along the way, we passed an actual burning bush, far to the right of our car. Most likely set by a nomad. No one even mentioned it. The story of the burning bush occurs in the Quran, too. The desert landscape of snakes and clans and prophets, with its traditions of the Tower of Babel and the Garden of Eden, is common to the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim holy books. And all three monotheisms share an even older set of myths from Mesopotamia, where the stories of Moses and Adam and Noah had moved like spirits for centuries under more ancient names.
"We are the same," Raleigh had told the pirates months ago in the bush when they inspected his crucifix. "We all got the same God."
But the Somalis were unconvinced. The cars stopped, and my guards led me to a patch of sand where a fat man sat on a blanket. He spoke decent English in a high, feminine voice and a correct manner, but it wasn't Garfanji. We shook hands and he introduced himself as Fuad.
"Nice meeting," he said. "You are not in very much danger unless your family will be uncooperative. You are now being held by the family that captured you."
"Okay."
"I belong to their subclan. I have lived in Europe before. Now I have come to mediate for you. I will live in Galkayo. I do not wish to remain more than 30 days, and I wish to have your case concluded in that time."
Fuad held a small packet of nuts, which he fed into his plump mouth.
"You are Saad," I said.
"Yes."
"My captors are demanding too much money," I told him.
"It's still at 20 million, isn't it?"
"I believe so, yes."
"Please explain to my captors that I am not a cargo ship." Fuad broke his grave, correct demeanor to titter out a laugh. He produced his phone, another elegant, orange-glowing Samsung. One purpose of the long drive was no doubt to use a distant cell tower to locate the call outside Galkayo.
"Hello?"
said my mother.
"Mom, it's me."
"Yes, hi, Michael, how are you?"
Her voice was clear and strong. The phone had beautiful reception. I couldn't tell how much she knew about my circumstances, but Mom seemed more self-assured than before. She asked,
"Are you still on the ship?"
"No," I muttered. And my stomach swirled. For the second time in my captivity, I worried that the horror, the hunger, the months of yearning, all the wasted time itself, had simply gone to waste. For 9 months, Abdul and Garfanji had fucked with us. Now negotiations would simply restart. If they had ever, in any sense, started.
My head spun on the dark savannah, and I wasn't sure what to say. I wanted to tip my location, but I didn't know if we would return to Gakayo, and uttering that name would have invited punishment. So I said, Ich bin da geblieben, wo ich gefangen worden bin. I've been staying in the place where I was captured. Yes, said my mother, and Fuad didn't notice the German. When the phone call ended, I was piled into the car, and we steered through the savannah again, without headlights, for several hours. This time we arrived at a pastel-painted villa, one of the pirate mansions I had read about as a journalist. A plastic-wrapped foam mattress lay on a concrete floor, along with a fresh mosquito net. I unwrapped the mattress, and the pirates came in with heavy sacks of beans and sugar, cases of pasta, cigarettes, and mango juice. The place was barren, unlit except for some dim fluorescent bulbs. One or two pirates remained visible through a doorway on a ragged mat. The light flickered over their heads, so the rectangle of the door seemed to flash on and off. When Bashko settled in the doorway, I asked him, This house, who? Who owns this house? Burad, he said. A pirate. Right, thanks, I glanced around. Are we still in Haradiri? Ha? Okay. Gokayo, then. It mattered for several reasons. As long as they maintained the Haradiri story, I had secret information to reveal on the phone. Our location also indicated which pirates were in charge. In Galkayo, assuming it was South Galkayo, they were Sa'ad, the family that captured you, as Fuad had said. A few nights earlier, in the broom closet bordello, a new boss had waddled in to sit on a plastic chair by the foot of my bed. He was shapeless and squat, with wide-set eyes, and he smoked a cigarette while he listened to long explanations from my guards. He glanced at me through the mosquito tent now and then, sidelong, to nod. I sensed he was learning about my time on the ship. I found him ugly and sinister, and I wondered if he belonged to a whole new gang. Now I decided Fuad had told the truth. The gang was Sa'ad, maybe Garlak and Dixie's family, as opposed to the Habyo crowd. We were back in Galkayo, and Fuad just possibly had meant it when he said 30 days. Chapter 4 The hollow house grew bright in the morning, but cold weather kept it from warming up. The pastel colors of the walls, solid blue, pink, or green, depending on the room, seemed to glow in the African sun. I saw that my room had plenty of open, dusty space. Several weeks had passed since I last exercised, so I wanted a yoga mat. Bashko, I said, since he sat in the doorway again. Bashko, I need a mat. Eh? Sali, I said, using the Somali word for a mat, which sounded like Sully. Aniga. I pointed at myself, then at the open floor. Exercise. Bashko gathered my meaning. Okay, he said, and lifted his thumb. The morning was so cold that he and Issa had wrapped themselves in blankets and built a coal fire. Bashko had dropped two or three hot coals from the kitchen into an empty powdered milk tin and set it in the entry hall. In the late morning, for laughs, or to ward off flies, he also threw rocks of incense into the tin and sent a small cloud of white smoke wandering through the doorway. The pirate villa started to smell like a Catholic church. Bashko, what is that? He came in to show me, carrying the hot tin with a rag. He made an exaggerated show of sniffing the smoke, which burned off in fierce, thick gouts and had a sharp odor somewhere between soap and spice. He set down the can and held out a spare rock of unburned incense resin, dried sap from the Somali bush. Somalia, full, he said. Somalia had more than one source of incense, including a gnarled tree that produced frankincense and a white thorn bush that gave up myrrh. Both grew throughout Yemen, Oman, and the Horn of Africa. The dried-out bushes and trees used to mean real money. The Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula had once belonged to a swerve of the spice route, and some traditions maintained that the wise men of the East were traders known to ancient Jews and early Christians from these pre-Muslim places. You could sell this to churches around the world, I told him, rubbing my fingers together. Business, business. Okay, Bashko laughed. A limited trade in both myrrh and frankincense resins existed in Somalia, and Bashko had a wiry intelligence that might have made him a good businessman. Part of me hoped that his share of my ransom, if any, would go toward funding an incense business. But I couldn't be too optimistic.
Boschko was also a cot addict, with a habit costing $600 a month. That was rent in some western cities. He returned the sensor to the hall doorway and waved at the smoke with a paper exercise booklet. The Somalis used this booklet to learn English. I pointed at it. Aniga, okay? I said. Can I read that?
Ha!
Boschko brought it over. I had left the Naham 3 without a Bible or a book of any kind. I devoured the pamphlet like a novel. It contained some poignant exercise questions. What is the purpose of human life? The purpose of life is to worship Allah. Who destroyed Somalia? Somalia was destroyed by Somalis, but most of all by the warlords. The other thing I noticed was a line at the bottom of each page indicating that the booklet belonged to an English class at a Galkayo private school, taught by a man named Abdurrahman. I'd heard the name Abdurrahman whenever Mustaf, the urbane young runner, delivered food. Boschko, I said, and described Mustaf. Magaid, I said, using a new vocabulary word from the book, meaning name. Abdurrahman, he answered carefully.
Abdurrahman the translator?
Yes, Boschko said. Interesting. I had gathered that Abdurrahman and Fuad were both in charge of negotiations. They worked together. The presence of Fuad in particular seemed to give everyone hope. The guards figured he was a pro because he spoke understandable English and he claimed to be an educated member of the Somali diaspora in Europe. I found out later that the FBI in California considered him a rational middleman, at least compared with previous negotiators. But his written English fluctuated between excellent and poor, and his ideas seemed to waver between sanity and nonsense. One possible reason for this divide was that Abdurrahman and Fuad traded email and telephone duties, and Abdurrahman had smoother English. Gunmen are winners here, one of them wrote in an email to my mother, while educated ones are losers in life. I must assure you that kidnappers holding your son are the most ignorant and not like civilized pirates we used to see. For the release of your innocent son who has been wrongly abducted, we fully cooperate with you by any means that can quicken his rescue. After a week or two of making hopeful signs and patchy correspondence following my phone call in the bush, in mid-October, Fuad announced a reduction in the ransom demand. At last, he wrote, the bosses decreased to $19,800,000 U.S. The fact that this bumbling criminal tag team woke up a glimmer of hope in California shows how desperate things had looked for most of 2012. My mother, in response, asked for a direct phone number to a pirate boss. Fuad wrote back, Hi, Marlis. I am also glad for our contact, and as human, I much feel pity for your problem. Dear, I can give you their number, but none of them speaks English. If you can understand Somali language or get one who can speak Somali in America with you, I can provide you their contact addresses. You have the choice. Thanks. Bye. Chapter 5. Abdel Nasser the Sahib came in one morning in October with a new, green, woven plastic mat, still wrapped in a clear plastic bag. He flopped it on the floor, tapped his chest with his fist in a gesture of brotherhood, and said, in his barrel-chested voice,
Sahib, Saleh, Adiga.
Thank you, Sahib.
Okay.
I asked for a broom and swept the concrete. I spread out the mat in front of a window and used it first to do push-ups. When I finished, three guards from the hall were staring into the room. Exercise, I told them. I figured the pirates would find yoga kind of strange, so I tried to wait for a gap in the afternoon when no guard sat by the door. But I was under close observation. The men seemed to have orders to watch me day and night. I started by standing on the mat and lowering my pulse with a series of deep breaths. I had done yoga in Berlin to keep myself in shape to surf, and I liked a tough regimen that made my heart beat and my skin sweat. Meditation was never the point. But in Somalia, I was so used to feeling wild with nerves that half an hour of mental concentration had a powerful effect. It calmed me for hours at a time. I moved through a few postures and noticed all the guards laughing and smiling at the door. Exercise, I said again.
Exercise, said Abdel Nasser.
Exercise, repeated Boschko, and he lifted his thumb. The next day, when I did it again, both men came into my room and spread flattened cardboard boxes on the unclean floor and imitated my postures with enthusiastic smiles. At first I thought they were goofing around. Soon they picked up their boxes, laughed, and went out. But it happened again the next day and the next.
To my intense surprise, they wanted to learn yoga. "No, put your feet there," I said. "Like that. Twist your back, like this."
"Okay, Sahib."
These lessons embarrassed the other pirates, but Bashko and Abdanasser and sometimes Isa came in for yoga class because they never got exercise of their own. They were locked in this pirate villa, too. I tried to imagine a yoga studio in Galkayo or the intrepid teacher who would venture to Somalia to spread this bizarre but calming discipline, which, since it came from India, might be viewed with derision and hate. Though, come to think of it, either Indians or Pakistanis did seem to live in town. Sometimes the pirates ordered batches of samosas for me, the greasy Indian snack East Africans call sambusi, and they arrived from a local shop in scraps of newspaper printed in Urdu, Arabic, Sinhalese, or occasionally English.
"Sahib, exercise," said Bashko when he needed help with a pose.
"Like this," I said. "Don't forget to breathe." They never held a pose long enough to accomplish very much, and sometimes out of boredom they shifted from yoga to quasi-military calisthenics. I saw stiff and comical marching drills as well as wild flailing backbends. I said, "Askari exercise," using the word for soldier, and Bashko lit up with pride.
"Askari, yes," he said.
"But you are Shifta," I teased him. "Thieves."
"Ah, yes,"
he added in a rare moment of bashful candor. When I quizzed him for biographical details, Bashko described himself as a Sa'ad from Mogadishu who had never worked as a pirate on the water. He'd trained instead as a soldier in Somalia and a commando in Russia. I had to weigh everything he said. Bashko's name did sound like a Slavic diminutive of Bashir, and Somalia had maintained political links to Russia under Siad Barre, but Bashko spoke no Russian. He was also vague about the weather in Moscow. He never mentioned snow. He boasted about commando training in Pakistan, too, and that seemed more plausible. He might have learned some English there. In any case, he was handy with a weapon, which suggested training, and he liked the word askari, which elevated his self-esteem. The word had an odd resonance because in East African countries, once under the colonial heel of the Italians or the British or the Germans, askari used to refer to local soldiers trained by a European colonial power. Gerlach had used it as an epithet, something like Uncle Tom. But for Bashko, it just meant soldier, which sounded better than thief. Bashko and Abdanasser both mimicked my yoga poses like housewives watching a weight loss video. Through these improvised classes, they became my sahibs in the pirate villa. Whenever I needed something, they were the guys to ask. Bashko, in particular, kept my hope alive with rumors of negotiations. He made it sound as if I would go free in a matter of days. Of course, I was happy to believe him. But then hope is like heroin for a hostage, and it can be just as destructive. Chapter 6. "This afternoon we must make a video for the UN," said Eunice in early November. "They will mediate your release."
"Really?"
I sat up on my mattress. Eunice loomed over me and seemed to sway with the uncertainty of his words.
"What kind of message?" I said.
"They want to know what you need for your health." Eunice had a high forehead, round, earnest eyes, and a light patch of hair on the end of his chin. In Hobyo, at least, his face had seemed friendly enough. Now he cultivated the deep, thuggish tones of a gang leader.
"In the video," he ordered, "you must say three things. You must give your name, you must talk about your health, and you must give a message to the United Nations."
I nodded.
"You must not give your location," he warned me.
"Don't mention Haradiri."
"Yeah,"
he said with a grin. After lunch, Abdurrahman appeared, still calling himself Mustaf, and wearing a white robe with a turban attached, an obvious costume unless he moonlighted as a sheikh. He also carried a digital camera. He hung the robe on a door and worked with several guards for a while in another room. I heard Bashko having an excited conversation in the hall. At last, he leaned into my doorway.
"Michael, news,"
he said, using his hand to indicate the motion of a flying plane.
"Rully and Mark, Seychelles."
I sat up. "Really?"
"Free,"
said Bashko.
"How much?"
$4 million. It was an exorbitant price, probably inflated by the rumor kitchen. The guards were encouraged by their bosses to believe that if two poor fishermen could be ransomed for a total of $4 million, Michael might fetch 8 or 10.
How exciting.
They talked about what to do with their cash. Most wanted to leave Somalia for Nairobi, Dubai, or even Europe.
Boshko, with another flying plane gesture, said, Akhmediriye, London. Really? I said.
Ha?
How? But there was no time. I had to put on a ma'awis, a sarong, instead of long pants. Eunice led me to the other room. The men had converted it to a movie set by suspending an orange tarp from lines tied to metal shutters. Inside this tent lay a torn and dusty mat, a bag with clothes spilling out, and a fire-blackened field kettle. All of it faced a window to let in natural light.
I see. We're in the bush now, I said.
Yeah, said Eunice. More pirate theater. He ordered me to kneel on the mat. Someone wrapped the chains from the broom closet bordello around my wrists and looped them over my neck. Boshko and Issa and two other guards wrapped their faces in kefiyes and surrounded me, aiming their weapons. Eunice asked questions while Abdurrahman pointed the camera.
What are the names of your parents?
Marlis Saunders and Vert Moore, I said. Hayes deceased, I added, in case they wanted to call him for money.
Your father is dead, said Eunice, who'd never heard this before.
Yes.
Do you have any diseases?
Not right now. We ran through the date and circumstances of my capture, and Eunice asked, Do you have any message for the UN?
These men tell me I'm about to go free, I said.
I hope that's true. I've been in Somalia for too long, and I don't have any glasses or lenses. I'm half blind, so, I'd like to request a pair of glasses.
Strange interview.
Afterward, I returned to my mattress, and for some reason I felt optimistic. It was early November, and the day felt bright and warm. For some reason, the bustle of excitement over the video and the gossip about the UN suggested real momentum toward my freedom. The only hitch in the stride of Eunice's questions was that my father was gone, and I wondered if it shocked him to hear I had only one parent left to rob. Chapter 7. I remembered a bargain emerald my father had once bought for $24.95 in a hinged plastic box, squirreled away in a drawer. The gem was faded green plastic. Dad went in for get-rich-quick schemes, and he'd ordered this one from the back pages of the L.A. Times. As a hostage, I could imagine three reasons for Dad to jump at such a gimcrack idea. It might have been A, drunken misjudgment, B, common panic about the family budget, or C, plain curiosity. But he never talked about the emerald, and he kept it in the desk in our study, where I sat with him sometimes to build model planes and ships. We glued plastic wings and tail sections together and painted them from little cube-shaped bottles of enamel paint that clacked in the drawer like thick glass dice. The father I remembered from my distant boyhood was enthusiastic and strong, but the older man, from my pre-adolescence, wore a troubled, clenched expression behind a pair of plastic sunglasses and seemed to take the world too seriously. I imagined the difference as a disturbance in psychic weather, a shift in the chemical patterns of his brain, and these perhaps heritable mysteries felt awful to contemplate in Somalia, where changes in psychic weather were so probable and sudden. For a 12-year-old boy, they would have been impossible to understand. At that age, you took everything personally. An adult who removed himself from your life did not obviously love you. In that sense, I was grateful for Mom's protection, since knowing details at that age would have left a permanent and baffling scar. But I couldn't submit to these memories in Somalia and cling to the notion of my dad as a rival. We would have locked horns when I grew up, but who cares? Fathers and sons did that. The lack of a father to struggle against was the unnatural part. I hated his drunken binges, but I didn't hate the man himself. I missed the man himself. Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter beheaded by Al-Qaeda after a wrong turn in Pakistan, had grown up in Encino, not far from Northridge. While I stretched on my mattress in Galkayo, I wondered if there was something about the dreariness of the L.A. suburbs that sent writers out to dangerous parts of the world, or something about white writers in particular who thought the world was theirs to explore. Travel itself was a privilege. Package tours from the United States or Europe to the developing world were vestiges of colonialism, in the sense that tourism rarely operated in the other direction. Overseas journalism and travel writing in the British or American vein, Gerald Hanley, Graham Greene, Paul Theroux, involved similar privileges. Then again, doing it well required no specific background, and it offended every instinct in my body to think that any writer of any shade of skin should not cover a certain story or travel to a certain place. Then again, I'd pushed the edges of privilege by chasing a book in Somalia. I'd taken a ridiculous risk. Then again, empires had always sent out travelers. Ibn Battuta, during an era of rising Ottoman power in the 1300s, had published an early and lasting description of Somalia, which he called Barbara, after a visit to the royal city of Moktasha, Mogadishu. The Sultan of Moktasha welcomed Ibn Battuta with a meal of rice and pickled mango. "A single person of the people of Moktasha eats as much as a whole company of us would eat," wrote Ibn Battuta, "and they are corpulent and fat in the extreme." Writers always went wrong, but it was miserable now to think that I had such a bleak story to tell. A story about captivity, assuming I got out at all, when I'd wanted to write something more rich and detached, more original, more humanizing. I also loathed the parochial idea that writers should just write what they know. Then again. My brain had time to waver over this question, back and forth. "You have made a mistake. Mistakes are human." Chapter 8. A day or two after our video, I asked to use the bathroom while a guard named Madobe sat watch in the doorway. "Kadi," I said. Madobe was the most pious acting pirate in the group. All the men scraped and bowed toward Mecca in the hall 5 times a day, but no one prayed with more punctiliousness or care. Madobe was long and precise, with a young, handsome face, but he seemed to be illiterate, and he could be tediously sarcastic and cruel. When he wasn't at his prayers, he chuckled and joked like a delinquent. He teased me about wanting ham. His skin was darker than the others, which made a difference in Somalia. The nickname Madobe meant black and referred to his color. He also belonged to a different clan, so even within the pirate gang, he may have felt like an outsider. "Kadi," I said. He didn't even glance over. I said, "Kadi," again, and held up an empty water bottle containing my toothbrush to show that I wanted to brush my teeth. No answer. He wasn't doing much in particular. "Kadi," I repeated and stood up. Now he sprang to attention with his rifle and shouted in Somali. The other men rushed into my room. When I raised my voice in protest, they all shouted as if I had tried to jump over the compound wall. Even Boshko pulled a pistol and shook it in my face, like Ali Dulai on the bluff. I had to sit down, but that wasn't good enough for Madobe, who strode into my room and kicked the plastic bottle out of my hand. "Bullshit," I muttered, which was a word they all understood. "Somali bullshit." "Shut up," said Boshko. Violence and fury were ecstatic states for these men, and the anger might simmer all day long until someone found an excuse to erupt. I remembered a line from Hanley. When the violence came, one hated it, and one came to know how it damaged one's slightly phony ideals about how man longed only for goodness and peace, whereas actually he loved fighting and knew he shouldn't. Hypocrisy is the keystone of civilization and should be cherished. I warmed to this idea in Galkayo. Before leaving Berlin, I had cherished the notion that civilized hypocrisy ought to be laid bare and corrected. The comforts of Western cities were just upholstery sewn over the violence and injustice at the heart of the civilized world, and I was against all that. I thought a writer should face unpleasantness, violence, entropy, and horror with unflinching eyes and an understanding heart. Right? Well then, this broken hostage world was all entropy and violence, and I was lying in it as punishment for my curiosity. I lacerated myself for believing I could learn something trenchant and real by coming to Somalia. An uncertainty principle follows writers into conflict zones, and I had noticed it even on the placid Turkish frigate in Djibouti. While we spent 4 days in the Gulf of Aden, another NATO vessel had captured a pirate mothership, a dhow full of kidnapped fishermen used by the pirates as slaves. These interesting people were rescued in the Gediz's usual sector. I said to our minder, Yashar, "You didn't have your sector changed just because of us, did you?" "Yes," he said. "You did?" "Yes," he smiled. "It is nice to have some quiet days." So the presence of journalists had shifted the ship's position. The uncertainty principle holds for writers and for anthropologists, quantum physicists, field researchers, even parents. Anyone in any role where the fact of observation can change the thing observed. What the fuck did I expect in Somalia? A tall white man hoping to make friends with pirates?
Even during my first days in Galkayo, I was aware of my extreme whiteness, and I knew very well that I was observing Africa through the eyes of a privileged stranger. The Horn of Africa had been hermetic and violent to outsiders since long before Richard Burton's 19th century excursions there, and people in Galkayo had seemed electrically aware of our presence in town. I also lacked Gerald Hanley's matter-of-fact reason to be in Somalia. His flights of lyricism and sense of drama as a white writer in Africa now rubbed me the wrong way. His ideas were good, but the romance of his style gave off too much perfume. The high sound of his prose contradicted his disillusionment about civilization and violence, and the supposed drama of writing about Africa left me feeling bitter and dull. Now I missed the upholstery of life in the West, the annoying banalities, the traffic, and the fluorescent-lit stores were intimate elements of my childhood. I couldn't reject them without rejecting my family, and I missed my family. I missed everyone I could remember. The end of my romance with Hanley's eloquence brought on a sharpened desire for the people I loved. There was no contradiction, because love isn't a question of dramatic demonstration or lyrical words. It's a question of attention, presence, and time, which was going to waste. Chapter 9. Eunice came and went, making gaseous promises about the UN and the ICRC, as if our video would lead to a tense handoff between the pirates and these international groups. He disappeared a day before my deadline. When I asked Bashko for news, he said, "No news." And when I asked if I could speak with Eunice, he said, "Eunice, coming." But Eunice didn't. His vague promises, along with the supposed UN video and Fuad's hint of 30 days, had swaddled my brain for 6 weeks in a soft narcotic hope. During the afternoon of Eunice's fictional deadline, this, my hope, burned off like mist. Evening arrived. The cool sunset over Galkayo brought mosquitoes, and even before dark I could hear their high, thin chorus in the courtyard. I had quit worrying about insects and disease on the Naham 3. Now they were a problem again. To fend off disease, I had to rely on my own immune system and the gauzy blue net that I unbundled every evening to dangle over my mattress like a lampshade. The food on the Naham 3 must have propped up my immune system, and maybe an unlikely optimism had stilted my health during my first month and a half in Galkayo. But when the sun vanished that evening in a whining haze of mosquitoes, a fever lit up my skeleton. I went to sleep feeling swollen and strange. I overslept in the morning and woke up dizzy. I ate about half my beans. I walked heavily to the bathroom. "Michael, problem?" said Bashko when I returned. "Aniga sick. Malaria feels like a heat in the bones and a leaden weight in the blood." I napped and woke up in a pool of sweat. I thought about Marie Dedieu, a Frenchwoman who'd been captured by Somalis from her second home on a northern Kenyan island in 2011. Pirate gangs, as well as factions of Al-Shabaab, had learned that skiffs could rush the sea boundary between Somalia and Kenya to kidnap vacationing Europeans. Madame Dedieu was a retired journalist and a quadriplegic who relied on drugs for a heart condition. The gunman had failed to understand her difficulties, and she died within a month. I asked for goat broth instead of spaghetti for lunch. This special order, with the rumor of illness, brought Eunice to the house, carrying a massive shoulder of meat. The guards cooked it while Eunice dodged my questions about going free. At last, he served me a plate of goat. "I can't eat all that," I said when he set it on the floor. "Soup only." I pushed away the plate, and Eunice made a show of thuggish surprise. "You refuse?" he said. "I don't refuse, Eunice. I'm sick. I can't eat it." "I don't believe you are sick. Believe what you want." The illness may have been related to stress over the promise of going free, but I was, in fact, sick, and Madame Dedieu's fate scared the hell out of me. "It is psychological," he said. "It is not fucking psychological. I need to see a doctor." "What for?" "I need a real doctor. Didn't you mention the ICRC? "Ha!" He smiled as if he'd caught me out. "You see, it is because of what I said to you. It is all in your head." "Fuck off," I said. The next morning, I couldn't hold down water. When I returned from the bathroom, I thought a swig from the water bottle might stabilize my swimming head. Instead, With nothing else in my belly, I puked.
Problem, said Boshko.
Yeah, problem, I agreed. Abdinasser the Sahib came in with an old shirt to help me clean up the water and stomach acid from the floor.
Kinin,
he said, and I thought he meant quinine. Boshko handed me a scrap of paper and a pen, and at last I understood.
Kinin meant medicine, and he wanted me to diagnose myself so they could order drugs on the phone.
No, I said. I need a doctor. A runner brought a malaria drug, chloroquine, which failed to do much good. I puked again in the morning. I felt sluggish and hot, like a radioactive log.
The same runner turned up the next evening with Eunice bearing a blood test kit, intending to draw blood. I hadn't showered in 2 days, and the entire house was filthy. Without real hygiene, I didn't want to come near a needle.
Do you have disinfectant? I said.
We do not need.
Oh, yes, we do. I need to see a doctor, Eunice. Bring a real doctor here. Someone from the ICRC.
Hearing ICRC again upset him. Eunice had taken lessons somewhere in bully boy manners. Any reasonable argument now impressed him as a threat.
If you do not take this test, he said, you will not receive any treatment.
He and the runner, a mild-faced man who came and went with a pistol tucked into his sarong, squatted in front of my mattress. I insisted on washing my hand with shampoo, since we had no soap. The runner turned out to be conscientious and careful. He drew a small vial of blood and went out. I spent the next day in a near stupor, misted with fever, but Eunice and the runner returned in the evening with a surprise. A local doctor had tested the blood and found both typhoid and malaria. Eunice now had a whole bag full of pharmaceuticals. He explained how to take the drugs, in what order, for how many days, everything the pharmacist had told him, and I was impressed. They had visited a real clinic in Galkayo. The hostage was an investment after all, and he had to be kept alive.
Chapter 10
I shivered under my blanket for 7 days and leaked sweat into my foam mattress. One drug, Cotection, seemed to lift me out of my feverish muddle. But there was nothing like disease in a prison house to strip off your mental defenses. On a normal day as a hostage, I had enough cussedness to resist the pirate's nonsense with a critical mind and hope for freedom in the not-too-distant future. With malaria in my blood, I wanted to die. My appetite returned, slowly, and I harassed the guards for better food. The runner brought bananas and limes for a week. Goat shoulder and soup came every 2 days. After I appeared healthy again, my diet regressed to a bowl of beans dusted with sugar in the morning, a bowl of almost dry spaghetti for lunch, and another bowl of beans when the sky deepened and the mosquitoes started to whine. Malaria can kill, so the ordeal humbled me. I had to reorder my head to move myself through an average day. I missed Raleigh and Mark, and I tried to imagine them in the Seychelles, their families, the mango tree, the yelling turtles. But I hedged any enthusiasm about their freedom the way I hedged everything I heard from the pirates. On the Naham 3, I'd compiled a list of crew names on a slab of cigarette cardboard so I could learn to spell them, along with a list of Creole fish names I'd learned from Raleigh. I had reproduced these lists on a few folded scraps of paper in my shorts pocket. One evening, while I scribbled on these scraps, Madobe crept up to my mosquito tent and hissed. I jumped and almost shouted. He confiscated my notes, and I threw a tantrum and compared Madobe to Somalia's last dictator.
Burad! Siad Barre! Same, same! I shouted.
These men loathed the memory of Siad Barre as much as they loved their self-images freedom fighters. I was clearly on edge. I had to find another way to manage the inarticulate stress. Without my notepaper, I learned to recite the lists of crewmen and fish names in my head every morning to keep them memorized. I had also left 2 unfinished books behind in Berlin, so, to keep my brain busy, I thought about the passages I wanted to change. Every morning I ran through what I could remember of the manuscripts and composed new paragraphs. Once I had a new section written, I started to rehearse it, the way an actor memorizes lines. Soon, I had a 2-hour drill. This mental strategy worked. It was not completely original. The idea came from the Indonesian novelist Pramodya Anantatur, who had spent 14 years in prison after a military coup in the 60s.
I had interviewed him in Jakarta in 2004, not long before his death. A sweet, smiling old man with bifocals who chain-smoked clove cigarettes. 10 of his years in captivity had consisted of hard labor on the jungle island of Buru, where convicts had to clear dense foliage and build their own barracks and roads. Usually during a break in forced labor, Primoidia told me, the inmates and I were gathered, and they would listen to my stories. When they worked somewhere else, they retold the stories to their friends. The other prisoners arranged for him to be excused from work for a few hours every day so he could sit at a desk. Imagining these stories, first for inmates, then on paper, he had kept his mind in order. So it occurred to me that story composition, even in silence, might keep me from losing mine. When I finished my recitations, I stood up to do yoga. Early sun shot through the windows every morning to light the painted concrete room, and while I faced the window on my feet, I could watch guards work in the yellowish courtyard, watering potted trees or washing saucepans from the kitchen. Running from this house was impossible, since the pirates lazed in the hallways leading to both doors. But I studied the courtyard every morning anyhow with my blurred, still optimistic eyes, looking for ways to escape. Sometimes the pirates paused at the front gate to peek through a gap at the road. They were locked in, too. Around midday, a phone would ring and a runner would open a smaller gate with his keys. He handed the pirates a bag of khat, which they carried into my room. The men surrounded the bag like sharks, and when each pirate had his share, he would thumb through the stems looking for a reddish tinge that meant ripe khat and a high afternoon. For me, these afternoons were long and terrifying. The heat mounted, the flies lost their minds. On the worst days, I took to lying on my mattress with one arm across my face to shield myself from the torture of their twitchy, intolerable legs. They tried to land on my lips, in my nostrils, on my eyeballs. The flies I knew from home had a near-magnetic evasion instinct for an oncoming hand, but hunger had taught these creatures a stubborn, headlong aggression. They didn't care if you hit them. Instead, they tried to land on the same patch of skin over and over to wear down a victim's will. Trying to kill them turned into a game, and I could fall into a delirious, zombie-like afternoon rut. Smack! I did that already. Smack! I did that already. Smack! I did that already. Smack! A fly would drop to the floor. Gunfire punctuated these passages of time like a savage cuckoo clock. People just fired their guns in the street. I was never sure whether someone had been wounded or killed. "They are happy," said Bashko. But I understood through these long hours that my sweaty idleness and indiscriminate fear profited no one but some distant investors. The only real tragedy in life is the being used by personally minded men for purposes which you recognize to be base, wrote George Bernard Shaw in a very different context. All the rest is at worst mere misfortune or mortality. This alone is misery, slavery, hell on earth. Smack. I did that already. 5 times a day, I heard distant muezzins. 5 times a day, the pirates swept khat leaves off their mats in the hall to spread thin cloths or sarongs at their feet. They faced north, crossed their arms, murmured Allahu Akbar, and started to kneel and scrape in a flowing, unchanging rhythm. Chapter 11. Somali bananas had an intense, tangy, sweet flavor, and in December, I hassled the guards to bring a supply of bananas and limes to eat instead of my second, rather disgusting bowl of sugared beans. Otherwise, I ate no fruit. I wanted a better diet. "Banana too much," said Bashko. "Banana good," I argued. "Banana lean vitamin good." Lean was the word for lime. I felt a lack of vitamin C. For a pirate gang demanding millions from my family, it wasn't a crazy demand. Bashko ordered one more bunch of bananas from the runner, but nothing else, and once they ran out, we had a simmering debate. I couldn't believe my guards found it easier to cook beans for me twice a day than to provide a cheap dose of fruit. So I borrowed a pen and drew an obsessive little diagram on a scrap of cardboard. First, there was my regimen of half-nutritious stodge. Digir, beans in the morning. Basto, dry spaghetti in the afternoon. Digir, beans at sundown. "Somali, no problem," I added with an angry flourish in ballpoint ink.
Then I gave them my idea of a more balanced prisoner's diet, which was still inadequate but should have been easier to prepare. Digir, beans, basto, pasta, banana lean, banana lime. Somali problem full, I wrote. Bosco took the scrap of cardboard and laughed. He handed it around to his friends, who all had a good chuckle. Somali no money, Bosco complained. Somali bullshit, I said. The next day, Bosco sat in the hall in a white plastic chair, which he'd found in another room and placed in the middle of a cot-littered mat. Two other guards, Issa and Abdul, curled around him like dogs. It was the sluggish hour before Kat arrived. Bosco wanted to banter again. Michael, he said with a grin. Somalia, money full? I sat up and smiled. No, no, I clarified. Barad, money full. Somalia wasn't rich, but its pirates were. Bosco repeated my phrase and grinned. Barad, money full. Yes, I insisted. Issa said he had a house in Galkayo. I don't own a house. Adiga no house? He said, surprised. No. Issa sat up from his doze. He remembered that my father, like his, was gone. But your father's house, he said. No, that's gone too. I stared at them. I don't own a car. Issa says he has a car. They were both surprised. Adiga no car? No. In Berlin, I didn't need one. But before, said Issa. I've owned a car in my lifetime, I said. Ah, okay. Bosco adjusted himself in the chair. Okay, Adiga, Aniga, no problem, he said. You and I are cool. But America, money full. Europe, money full. In Somalia, he added, hungry problem. That's true, I said and held his eyes. No good. A brutal famine had killed thousands of people in other parts of Somalia in 2011 and 2012, but I couldn't tell whether Bosco was also claiming starvation. Refugees from within Somalia had fled to Galmudug because of the relative prosperity there. America was not always rich, I said. Europe was not always rich. You have to build up, slow, slow, I said, and made a stepwise motion with my hand. We were limited by our failures of language to some pretty crude arguments. We left out the ravages of colonialism. We left out the Somali climate and 100 other complications. Indonesia isn't rich, I went on. It's poor and Muslim with many Sufis like Somalia. They don't shoot each other, by and large. They have roads and decent shops. A lot of people don't have cars, but they ride scooters. You can raise a family in peace, I shrugged. Indonesia's nice. Muslim, said Bosco. Yes. Muslim good. Sure. Bosco was surprised to hear such a thing from me. So far, I'd been treated like a prisoner of a vague but global war, a captive from a distant subclan that by definition hated Muslims. I did not hate Muslims. But now I had a chance to ask a question that had baffled me for most of the year. Bosco, you are a Muslim. Yes, but you are also a thief. I bumped my fingers together, which by now was a comprehensible gesture for us. These things don't fit together. No, same, same. A smile crept over his face as my intention dawned. He laughed and rattled a translation to his friends. Hmm, said Issa. Bosco straightened up in his chair and tapped his chest. I am a Muslim, he said, but I am also a thief. Why? Because in Somalia, hungry problem. As if Allah could outlaw thievery but make exceptions for pirates. It's okay, guys, you're poor. Once you steal enough money, you can be good Muslims. I don't think Islam works like that, I said. Bosco had a spry, combative mind, so the theological problem bothered him for the next 2 weeks. We returned to it one morning while I ate my dawn ration of beans. He'd been lazy about cooking them, and I had threatened a hunger strike. He'd lost our little showdown and delivered the bowl with ill grace, like a man feeding a dog. He watched me eat with fervid, resentful eyes. Michael. What? Muslim, he said and smiled wickedly. No chum chum, no problem. Oh? Christian, no chum chum, problem full. A Muslim could tolerate hunger, in other words, unlike a certain Christian in the room. I wiped my fingers clean with a scrap of toilet paper. I had great stoic reserves, but I was not about to go hungry just to make life easier for a bunch of lazy pirates. Bosco, I said in our mutual language,
Last week you said a Muslim could be a pirate because of the hunger problem. He nodded. Now you say a good Muslim has to bear up under